Accession number 10693, rule 4.
Colonel Norman, rule. What sort of training were you doing at Dunalley?
Well, a lot of individual training, always. My battalion was always very keen indeed on shooting. We did a lot of shooting. I suppose there were riot exercises, but I can't really remember that. And I can remember company training, and also battalion training, when most of the battalion came up and we did a big exercise. But the details of it, I simply can't remember really at all. Night exercises we did all over the surrounding villages. I remember the whole battalion walking through a river one day, rather pleased because it was terribly hot, to be able to get our feet nice and cool.
What was the terrain like around Dunalley?
It was hilly. It's up in the Deccan, so it's much healthier than down below in Bombay. And in the evening, the nights really were very pleasantly cool all the time I was there. And it was really a health station. I think that's why it was chosen in the war, both wars, I believe, as being a sort of acclimatisation place of chaps coming out from home before being moved on to something a bit more severe in the way of climate.
Presumably, then, it was quite athletic when you were chasing each other over the mountains.
Oh, yes, we were always very fit. As I was later on in very hot weather indeed. My weight used to go down to just about 10 stone in those days in really hot weather.
Had there been a great emphasis on night exercises?
Yes, we did a lot of that sort of thing in Dealali. I don't know why, whether it was because my company commander was especially keen, but we did a lot of night marches on compasses. So much so that when I went home from India, I bought myself an oil compass, which is so much easier to use than the ordinary government-issue prismatic compass. In fact, I've still got it here. And we were pretty good at it. There's a certain amount of competition between platoons. You'd be given a set of bearings to march on, and you had to count your paces. You had a pacemaker. And he was absolutely most of the chap you really had to rely on, the pacemaker and the compass, otherwise you were nowhere at all.
Were there any men in your platoon who found it difficult to adjust to being in India?
I don't think so, no. Most of them have been there longer than me. I'd come out at the beginning of 1936, and we left at the beginning of 1937, and they'd all been there either at the same time as me or before. I don't think there are much in the way of drafts arrived after I had, and they seemed to be. I was amazed actually when I first got out there how very fit everybody looked compared to how they'd been in England. Well, mind you, in England I had a motorised platoon, so we never walked a yard except on church parade on Sundays or something like that, ceremonial parades. But also, they seem to be a fitter and nicer lot in many ways. It's much cleaner. Of course, you had to be clean in India, or else you smelt. And of course, the troops did smell a bit in England, as a matter of fact. Those thick serge uniforms, and never sent to cleaners or anything like that. But when you got out to India and you saw these chaps who were very brown and wearing the minimum of clothing, probably very fit and clean-looking chaps, and of course the washing arrangements were so much better in India. Everybody changed their clothes certainly twice a day, if not more often than that, and so everybody was terribly clean, and it was you felt that you were in a very healthy company there. I got prickly heat was the only thing that went wrong with me when I was there, and I got it very badly indeed, and it was terribly uncomfortable. But that's the only time I got any illness there.
Besides the business of keeping yourself and your clothing particularly clean. Were there other measures that had to be taken for purposes of hygiene?
I suppose there were. I can't recollect any, though. I don't think we've had sort of mepocrine or anything like that dished out for people to take doses every day, like I believe we did later on in the war, but I can't remember that either. And I know later on in Korea we used to take salt tablets, because otherwise you got the most frightful cramp, as I did, and still do, as a matter of fact.
When you were doing your training, did you train through the heat of the day, or did you stop when the sun got high?
We stopped. I think all the time there we stopped midday or lunchtime, and then rest until games in the evening. Aren't you? We started jolly early, always.
What time would Reveille be normally?
I should say just about daylight.
So you'd be up with the sun?
Yes.
And working till around midday?
Yes. In Deolalia there was an officer's club, quite small, but really rather pleasant, and it had a golf course attached. Nothing very elaborate about that. And a swimming bath, and a billiard table, and that was about all. And a bar, of course. But it was enough.
You mentioned games in the evening. What sort of games were favoured?
Football, rugger. I can't remember cricket being played, but I'm sure it must have done. I was a referee at football. Incidentally, one of the toughest examinations I've ever taken, written and practical. And you had to get a very high percentage of marks in the written exam, I remember. And so I was no good at football myself, but I used to do refereeing because I couldn't do anything else worthwhile. I remember one of my best friends being knocked out as he was playing in goal, and I had to take him off to the hospital. He got concussed.
Did you manage to play polo while you were at
Duvalet? No, I never played polo at all until I got, because it was much too expensive. There wasn't any polo in Deolalia. The two or three really good players in the regiment played polo down in Bombay, where it was very expensive and sort of rather fashionable. I never got as far as that at all until I got to the Sudan, and then I started, where it was much cheaper. And of course, later on in China, it was much cheaper still.
When you arrived, Doolally, how did your platoon receive you?
I can't remember at all. I think sort of rather resigned about it all. Here comes another one. We've got to teach him how to work. They were a very agreeable lot.
Roughly how much of the time during training were you controlling things directly, as opposed to leaving it to the sergeant?
Oh, well, to start with, yes, that's quite a point. To start with, I was completely at sea, because I've been an anti-tank platoon commander, which is completely different from being a rifle platoon commander, which I was right back to the basics. And I hadn't done anything like that ever. I'd been in the OTC, which I never took very seriously, I must admit. And so I did have to be taught to start with. It didn't take long to pick up, and I was quite a decent rifle shot also, so that part, and pistol, that part was no trouble at all. No, I think it came to common sense, and it didn't. My period of bewilderment didn't last very long.
Who actually taught you? Was it the sergeant?
I think the sergeant and my brother officers, rather platoon commanders, just sort of copying what they were doing. And I think my company commander thought it a bit odd that I didn't know how to command a platoon tactically. But then he was an odd chap himself.
How did you keep discipline in the platoon? Did you use formal methods or rely on the NCOs, or use informal methods?
Don't have to do anything very much in the way of formal methods at all, ever, as a platoon commander. They were so much more experienced, and they'd been there for, some of them had been there for a very long time in India, They knew the form. There was not much you could do in the way of getting into trouble, certainly not up at Deer Lally. In Bombay a bit, yes, but I don't remember anything serious ever happening up there. And there were no excitements. It really was very boring, I suppose. We had to try and keep the chaps interested all the time. I can remember the detachment commander, who was also the, what's the word, cantonment, president of the cantonment. That was a sort of he was a sort of Lord Mayor of Deer Lally, as well as being detachment commander. And there were very few excitements. He was called upon to shoot a rabid dog once, remember, and also to go and chase a tiger. The villagers had got a tiger who was causing a lot of trouble in the neighbourhood, and he went out after it. I'm blown if I can remember whether he shot it or not, but he was a very good shot, so he probably did if he saw it.
So you didn't have much crime?
No, there was actually nothing you could be criminal about. There's an awful, terrific emphasis on competition, games competitions between the two companies which are up there at the time. Rather too much, actually. There was a certain amount of bitter feeling went on, and one of the company commanders really sort of got to the stage where he was always not on speaking terms with the other company commander.
But he just took it too seriously,
much
did he?
Much too seriously, yes. I think it ought to have been abolished. But it kept the chaps interested, all right. Hockey is another game, of course, they played a lot in India always.
When they
especially
were
those soldiers who'd been born in India, and there were some, mostly in the band or bugles, always marvellous at hockey. It seemed to be the great game in India, and anybody who'd ever lived in India for any length of time was always jolly good at hockey.
You say there was competition. Was it led by having prizes or anything?
You got a cup, I think. You might have got rather cheap medals, like I've got in the case behind me of shooting medals made of bronze and knocked out by Galen Polden or somewhere like that in Aldershot, costing nothing at all, but you just the name of the competition written on it, not even your own name. I dare say you've got those.
Did the competition extend throughout all activities? Did it cover games and tactical training? And
it certainly covered rifle shooting, I think. Well, all sorts of shooting. I think it was pretty broad, covered pretty well everything. I think there are some things you can't really judge competitively.
When you were training tactically in the hills, were you mainly training for offensive tactics or for defensive?
Oh, both. I always rather fancied myself on defensive arrangements, rightly or wrongly.
Did you ever train with other arms in support?
Not in Deer Lally, there weren't any.
It was just purely the two companies training on their own?
That's it, until the battalion came up. But no, there weren't any other arms in Deer Lally, and I was trying to think of what there were in Bombay. There must have been sappers and miners, I seem to remember. And also in Deer Lally, there was a company of the Indian Army, 3rd 1st Rajputana Rifles, was it? No, 3rd 1st Punjabi Regiment, I think it was, had a detachment up there at the same time. And I can't remember having anything to do with them. They had their own mess. Didn't mess with us.
What was your food like?
Very plain. We used to eat. It was plain, but quite good and adequate. Nothing elaborate about it. I was PMC, for part of the time in Bombay, and I arranged a colossal dinner. I can't remember what it was in aid of, but I thought we ought to have one good dinner for some reason or other. And I sent for some food from the Army and Navy stores in Bombay. Can't remember what it was. I think it might have been, you know, a saddle of mutton or something like that, something rather special. And, of course, it all arrived, and I went elsewhere. I wasn't had to dinner. I think I soaked some prunes in gin, too, which is for the occasion.
Did the cuisine in the mess make any concessions to your being in India? Did you have a lot of curries?
No. I don't know whether it's peculiar to my regiment, and I think it's wrong, really. We never really went in for local food wherever we were. I can remember before the war, I think I only once had a, or perhaps twice had a Chinese meal when I was living in China. And I can't honestly remember having curry at all in India. I suppose I must have done. But we didn't go in for... We used to go in for local fruits, like mangoes, which are absolutely marvellous. Certainly, in fact, in Bombay, we had mangoes growing in the mess garden. We went in for those, all right. And there was a government sort of... up in Dialali, there was a government farm or something or other, and we used to eat meat from that. And also, there was a government dairy, and we had cream with our cereal every day. But that was pretty unusual.
So, would it be fair to say that you were on a basically English diet?
Oh, yes, would be. I think also in those days, people were pretty windy about hygiene in the way of how food was produced. And I think it was the general idea was to keep things simple and make sure that hygienically everything was okay. I remember in Shanghai later on, I was PMC. And there was a cholera scare, and every single piece of fruit and vegetable had to be boiled before it was consumed. So you had black bananas and horrible-looking things like that turned up at the table. But it was very, very strict about it. And, of course, with vegetables all over the East, you've got to be strict. I think they were always soaked in what they call pinky pani before being dealt with or eaten.
Was that potassium permanganate?
I think so, yes. I can't remember what it's ever been called anything but pinky pani. And how I remember that, I can't imagine either.
You mentioned doing training around the local villages. Did you have anything much to do with the population?
None at all. Absolutely none at all. They were rather repulsive. They were always surrounded by cactuses, which I can't stand. I always hated cactuses. I don't think I ever went into the sort of town of Dialali at all. It was separated, but not by any length of any distance at all. It was just one part was the cantonment, one part was the barracks. And we, our mess actually, was quite a long way from the barracks. You had to have a bicycle to do it. Bicycle polo was another game we used to play. Gosh, it's dangerous.
Did you have native servants?
Oh, yes. I started with a Punjabi Muslim who was very good. After a bit, he said he got to go home. Well, they always did that, to look after his land up in Punjab. And for a very short time, I took the head Kitmagar from the mess, but he was absolutely hopeless. He was also a Muslim. He just didn't understand the business at all. Cack-handed, no memory whatsoever, and just didn't know how to work. He was such a nice chap too, so I had to get rid of him, and I finished up, most unusually, with a Hindu who was absolutely first class, except he was frightfully short-sighted and was too vain to wear glasses. And I used to make him play my gramophone when I was in the bath, and he never could hit the record first time. Awfully nice man he was. And it was very unusual to have a Hindu when everybody else was having Muslim.
Was there then a general preference for Muslim men?
Yes, definitely.
Why was that?
Well, I think possibly because they worshipped God, and the Hindus were rather looked down upon for worshipping other things. And one couldn't understand, really, their religious ideas. Not that one tried very hard either.
Now, you mentioned that you got involved in some internal security duties in Bombay.
Yes. There wasn't any trouble, really, because as soon as the soldiery appeared, everything quietened down, which is absolutely first class. But I can remember going on twice I went out, I think, once doing a sort of showing the flag in a vehicle with a wireless on it. One of the very first wirelesses I think we ever had. It must have been a police car. I was in with a wireless broadcasting back to battalion headquarters exactly where I was and what was happening all the way around. On another occasion, we surrounded an area with the magistrate and the police. Nothing happened again. It was very peaceful. But when we weren't there, it was different. They'd throwing stones at each other's temples and mosques and that sort of thing. It could have been nasty, but because we were always ready to get out jolly quickly, we used to practice this sort of thing in a tremendous lot. You would hear the bugles going off for the sounding of the alarm, and everybody immediately dashed into battalion headquarters. It was very, very quick always. Although where we were, Calaba, was some way out of the main part of the town, we were pretty quick always.
What was the trouble about then? Was it exclusively religious?
Oh, yes, yes. As far as I can remember, it was simply the sects, the Hindus and the Muslims, insulting each other and raising riots, which happened a good deal, provoking each other quite deliberately.
Did you ever come across any signs of the Indian nationalist movement, the Congress Party?
Absolutely not. My impression was that the British in those days, 1936, were really rather popular in India.
When you went out to quell a riot, what sort of formation would you adopt when you got into the area where the trouble was going on?
Well, it depended if you're on foot, of course, or in vehicles. If you're on foot, the usual business of lining chaps on going up a street. On either side, you'd have a column on the right, we'd be looking at the houses on the left, and the other way around. That's about all I can remember. You had to be quick, very quick off the mark. As soon as you got out of your vehicles, you had to be jolly quick. We spent a lot of time on that, but the details of it I simply can't remember.
Did you ever have to open fire?
Not in my time, ever. In that year in India, certainly nobody opened fire. I'm pretty sure, certain about that.
When you went out on that sort of duty, did the troops carry lathis or anything of that sort?
No, only rifles or pistols. And I think they were very strict about there being no sort of anything at all. If you had to use force, and you only used it with permission of the magistrate, it was one man, one round, and shoot. Not to wound, to kill. That was the theory in those days anyway. I think the reason to kill was that if you wounded a chap, it would raise them hatred even more, possibly. But anyway, that was the rule.
Who would pick out the man who was to be shot?
The platoon commander. I think it would be the platoon or the senior officer present. Because once the magistrate had said, this is beyond my control, you have my permission to take over. You took over, and it was your responsibility. You always had a clerk with you too, who wrote down exactly what happened. And it was very strict rules about how this thing was dealt with. You had to have a flag, you had to have a loudspeaker, and you had to give the chaps, the rioters, a chance to withdraw peacefully. And all this was recorded, because we always feared there'd be accusations afterwards that you've used unnecessary force, or you shouldn't have used any force at all, or the rioters were peaceful and so on. And so this is the thing, we had to protect ourselves very carefully about this.
So these were measures against subsequent agitation?
Yes.
Did you ever discuss the use of riot shields or anything of that sort of protection against stone throwing?
I don't know. I don't think we did. I don't think, you know, we ever expected to get to the stage of using force at all. We thought the appearance of a large number of British troops armed would be enough to send everybody home, and so it proved, in my experience anyway. Mind you, I know that it's not so long before that this Sikh business happened up at Amritsar. But that was what one always worried about, and of course serious mistakes must have been made on that occasion. And we were determined not to do anything like that, and we were all right.
What did the soldiers think of that sort of duty?
They thought it was damn boring, I think. but something out of the ordinary. Better than going for a route march with a gas mask on in the hot weather in Bombay, I can tell you, when you had to keep on doing lifting up the mask so the sweat could come out, and you could, it was very, very unpleasant, that form of sport. You had a weekly holiday too, you know, in Bombay, in India, as you did in most tropical areas, I think, in those days. It was called interior economy, cleaning up your kit and your barrack rooms and so on, and recreation. We used to take our company or platoons out to a public bathing place called Breach Candy, which was really rather nice. It was salt water, came from the sea, in a big, very, very big swimming pool, with diving boards and so on, and tables under chairs and under trees, and jolly good beer too.
Like a sort of naval make and mend day.
Yes. Yes.
Did you have much to do with the magistrates?
Nothing at all. That's the only time I ever met a magistrate. It was on this surrounding lark, surrounding the building for terrorists or rioters.
Was the magistrate a European or a
Yes, Asian? He was European. I remember he promised to give me some of the weapons he'd collected, but he never did.
Did you have any liaison with the Indian police?
Well, they would have been present on these occasions, yes, but apart from that, never. Not that I can remember.
Did you remember having any impression of what they were like?
No, they always looked very smart. Well, that's about all. There wasn't much police presence. It was a very peaceful place, really, Bombay, except for these riots in the industrial area. And they were nothing like as much as they could be.
Was there a lot of destruction of property?
No, not on that occasion at all, I don't think.
Many casualties?
No. I think, you know, a few broken heads. But I don't think anybody ever got killed at that time.
Just a genteel sort of rioting.
Yes, well, I think if one hadn't taken very strong measures at once, it could have brewed up into something more serious. But we were there. There was a British battalion, there was an Indian Army battalion, and we were prepared, trained for that sort of thing, and we were prepared to do it efficiently, and as we always did do it efficiently, it never brewed up into anything really serious.
What could you do in Bombay when you were not working, other than going to Breach Candy? What amusements?
I can't admit, there weren't any amusements. It was the most boring place, I think. I hated it. Never got invited out to any civilian household the whole time I was there, in spite of having paid calls on all the people I was supposed to call, from the governor down. In fact, the governor's residence was the only civilian household I did go into, and that was his sort of annual ball.